7, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. It's always good to see both of you. And I know that we have kind of an interesting show today because we're going to be talking about a story that one of our viewer listeners submitted to us about piloting command and decision making. And we'll get to that here shortly. But Todd, I know you have some acknowledgments for not only members, but our sponsors.
Yes, indeed. Well, first off, as you know, we have memberships here at Flight Safety Detectives, and we're always inviting folks to join as a member. And for those of you watching the video version of it, you'll see a join arrow on the page where our website resides. And one of the benefits you have from being a member is we do a shout out. And today's shout out is to Bradley Williams, your Flight Safety Detectives, Flight Safety Insider level member. And one of those membership benefits is a shout out like we're doing today. And the other benefits, among the other benefits, will be shows that only insiders can see and other special goodies that we haven't quite created yet, but we will.
We're working on it. There's some of the new bling that we're going to have available to those of those members out there besides some other cool stuff. So
not only that, as you know, we are also very much into working with partners out there who'd like to work with Flight Safety Detectives, putting their information in front of our audience. So again, if you want to have want to be a sponsor of our show, not just a member, but a sponsor, especially if you have a product or service, please write to us at flightsafetysponsors@gmail.com. One of the sponsors that we have, and we'll hear about that later in the show, we'll have a bit of an ad from them, is ProChalk. And not only are we talking about ProChalks, not only are they a sponsor of the show, you, Greg, you're a customer.
I am. And I'll tell you what, I like these chalks. These are the small, low-profile chalks. They are functional. They do the job on my airplane. The nice thing is, though, while they are still high-density rubber and they do the job, they're lightweight. When I take them out from underneath the wheel on my airplane, I put them around my neck. Again, now I know I've pulled the chalks. I know where they are, and I can throw them in the airplane. So I really like these low-profile chalks. And, of course, they come in a variety of different sizes for the size of your airplane. But, you know, it's great that they're a sponsor. And, again, you know, this, as John always talks about, these are safety devices for a variety of different reasons, whether you're just tying the airplane down or you're going to hand prop the aircraft. You know, there is a purpose for these chocks, and you should always have a set of chocks with you in the aircraft for no matter where you're landing. Even if you're just parking, you know, to go have lunch, chalk the airplane.
You know, today I was at an FBO today, and I saw a guy. I didn't see him come in, but when I just happened to be looking out the window, and he was prepping his airplane to leave, and lo and behold, he had a pair of those chocks, pulled them out and put them inside the airplane.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they're lightweight, but you always want to have your own chocks. You can't depend on places that you go to chalk your airplane or even tie the aircraft down. So if nothing else and you're parking only temporary, even if you're going to fuel the airplane at a self-service pump, it's always a good idea to chalk the aircraft because, again, the ramps are not always level. You have a gust of wind or something happens or a big airplane comes by and, you know, is throttled up, whether it's a big propeller or jet aircraft. Next thing you know, your airplane's moving. So, you know, chocks are easy. They're simple to use. They're lightweight. So use them.
And here's one last idea, which is not given to us by the sponsor, but one that just popped in my head. Let's say you're an aspiring aviator or aviation professional, or you have one in your family, or a close friend of yours is one. How about getting one of these chocks, customizing it with something on the chalk, the name, the company name, whatever. Give it to them as a present. Even if you don't own a Citation like you do, Greg, or whatever it is you fly. You can afford to buy a set of chocks, customize them any way you want, and put it out there as a reminder of why you love aviation.
You know, I'm also using these in my garage for parking my car.
Cool.
So that I can pull in far enough. I hit the chalk. I know that I know I'm going to have enough room for the garage door to close. So, I mean, they serve multiple purposes other than for aircraft, but you know, the nice thing is you can identify them as yours by whatever you put on the chalk. So
now most of our audience showed up here not to hear about the wonderful products that our sponsors are offering, but to hear about an aviation safety story or two. And this is we're recording this on the 8th of October. Exactly a week ago, we had a bit of an aviation story in New York. And as many of you know, if a story about aviation happens in New York, it's at least a national story. And that's how I heard about it on the national news. They said, well, two jets run into each other at LaGuardia. I thought, that's not good. And of course, this is the modern era. So there were still photos and videos of this collision. And it's kind of unusual because, and I haven't found a very, very good picture that shows this, but it looks as though the wing of one of the aircraft hit the side of the cockpit and actually might have damaged or shattered the windscreen of the captain. And you'd have to think, you're going down the taxiway, you're trying to take off, it's nighttime, normal night, and suddenly you see an airplane coming at you, you see a wing coming at your window, that might give you a shiver or two.
Well, that's if you've seen it, because again, you had two different crews doing two different things. Of course, the one aircraft, as it was taxiing to for departure, heading to runway 4, it would have been on the first officer's side that winglet or wingtip would have struck the aircraft that was waiting to cross. It's apparent that the first officer either didn't notice how close the proximity was of their aircraft to the aircraft they eventually struck, or she may have been heads down running a checklist in preparation for departure, because there is a taxi checklist and you're getting the aircraft prepared, so you may have been heads down. Meanwhile, the captain being on the left side of the aircraft at night is tracking taxiway center line and may have seen the aircraft, but is not studying the proximity of his aircraft to it. And then for the other aircraft that was coming at them, if you will, at an oblique angle, again, they were coming off a taxiway. They had just landed. They may have been doing cleanup items. So there's a lot we don't know yet. I'm sure the NTSB and the FAA will hopefully get that information through interviews. And, of course, the cockpit voice recorders on both aircraft, I'm sure, have been pulled, which will help at least gap fill some of the storyline. But, you know, when we look at accidents like this, Todd, and this isn't the first time, I've done a number of these accidents at JFK, LaGuardia, Newark. But with LaGuardia, one, and John, you can speak to this because I think you turned wrenches there for a little while, and that is, it's a very compact airport, unlike Atlanta, Denver, you know, some of the bigger airports where you have a lot of space. There isn't a lot of space between taxiways, runways, and then the ramp area. So you have to be right on where you're stopping your aircraft or where you're taxiing your aircraft, because you just don't have large margins of safety as far as distance between aircraft. And of course, the bigger the aircraft, the smaller that margin is, because you got large wingspans and things like that. So that's an issue that I'm sure the board should be looking at.
LaGuardia is one of those airports where there is no room. I mean, I've been to LaGuardia. I worked there. I've been there a lot since I'm no longer working for the airlines. And I walked around that airport, and the wingtips, and sometimes you could touch both of them. Airplanes are that close together. The congestion there is just probably the worst in the country. It's pretty tight, you know, and add in a little disruptive flow. So when you have airplanes backed up, and you have airplanes in really close proximity. Now that does a couple of things. It makes the people who fly in and out of there sort of immune to paying attention to it, right? Because it happens every day or every time I come into that airport, right? And it becomes the norm. It becomes, you know, that's the way it is. And that kind of complacency will get you in trouble. And I'll bet this particular event has some complacency in it.
Now, this particular event happened on October 1st. And as many of you know, especially if you're seeing this close to the time we're recording it, the government shut down starting on the morning of October 1st. Now, it didn't affect air traffic controllers. They're still at work. But it's going to be one of the questions I hope that they address. What, if any, effect the government shutdown that started earlier that day had at LaGuardia?
Yeah, and there's a lot of dissection of the communications. Were both aircraft on the same frequency? Did each hear the other's instructions? And the instruction that I heard for the aircraft that was taxiing out for departure, they had a bit of a confusing type of clearance. They were cleared to taxi on Alpha to a couple of other taxiways to the runway. Then they were told, hold short of Mike. Well, the way the clearance came across to the crew, you would think that taxiway Mike that they were supposed to be holding short of was near the departure end of the runway, which was still quite a distance away, when in fact, taxiway Mike was the taxiway that they eventually met the other aircraft on. So phraseology, and we've talked about phraseology with the DCA midair. Phraseology means everything. And if it's not proper phraseology, there's always the possibility of misinterpretation, miscommunication. And that should be really examined in this case as well. Because again, you want to be short, concise, and to the point. The air traffic controllers are talking a mile a minute. You got to really grasp it. I would like to know, given the fact that this was two Endeavor aircraft, they are the regional carriers, I'd like to know what the experience level is of all four of those pilots. Now, it's obvious that the captain had been around on each of those airplanes for a while, but did they just recently upgrade to a captain? And then are the first officers relatively new? Are they going into this airport for the first time? Is this a new experience for them? And then, of course, you do have there is a RAS system, which is a runway advisory system, where you can monitor as you're taxiing to see if there's other aircraft in close proximity and things like that. So, and then, of course, the airport has ASDX. So they have ground-based radar that they're tracking those airplanes. Why wasn't there a warning given as far as, you know, hey, I see both these aircraft moving, stop, somebody stop, you know? So there's a lot of unanswered questions at this point. And like you said, Todd, because of the government shutdown, I'm not sure we're going to see a prelim anytime soon, because the government, at least the NTSB has declared that, you know, they're not going to do any work unless it's a major accident. Well, this is definitely, and they're not considering it a major accident. And they're going to ride the wave for a while until they have to put out a prelim. But again, there's valuable information to be learned. And all of a sudden now we're sitting on it. Or I'm sorry, we're not sitting on it. They're sitting on it. And, you know, if there is an issue with air traffic, if there is an issue with the airport or a combination thereof, or either one of these flight crews, that needs to be known now, not a month from now, not 6 months from now, but now, because corrective actions need to be taken. That's the whole purpose of doing an investigation.
Now, one thing that is not unusual in the world of aviation are airliners running into each other on the ground. These kinds of incidents happening during taxi, happening coming in and out of the gate, going to and from maintenance, happens all the time. What rarely happens is it becomes a major news item and it gets investigated by NTSB or a similar organization. I've seen many of these over the years. And you know, even those that are relatively minor, where you think this is not a big deal, when they're properly investigated, when they're deeply investigated, all sorts of insights come to the forefront.
Yeah, I'm working an accident that took place at Houston Hobby Airport where you had two airplanes on perpendicular runways, crossing runways. One airplane landed, the other airplane took off without a takeoff clearance, and they unfortunately met at an intersection. The good thing is that the damage to one of the aircraft, which was taken off, wasn't so severe that they couldn't get the airplane airborne, which they did, but then came back. But the fact is that, like you said, I mean, these events, they're not happening every day, but they are not a rare occurrence. But there are lessons to be learned. And if there's shortcomings, especially right now in the air traffic control system, since it is in the spotlight because of the government shutdown, it's been in the spotlight for a while. But it's even got a brighter light on it now because of the shutdown and, you know, the shortage and then controllers calling out sick. Now you're putting a real burden on the system as a whole. And that has to be determined whether or not that has any kind of influence on air traffic controllers trying to handle more aircraft than they're capable, because an air traffic controller can't handle 25, 30 airplanes at one shot. That's asking too much. Was there good coordination if these aircraft were on two separate frequencies? There's a variety of different questions that still need to be answered. John, you sit there, you're just pondering all of this. I know Yes. You have some words of wisdom, though.
No, I'm just thinking about my time with the air traffic controllers and how difficult that job can be in certain airports, and LaGuardia is one of them.
Yeah.
You know, Newark's another one, New York airports. Kennedy is somewhat, most of the day is a little more relaxed, but they have their moments as well.
Yeah, and I mean, we've had issues. I mean, Atlanta Hartsfield, not only do we have airplanes, you know, taking off on a taxiway, we got them landing on a taxiway. I mean, this kind of stuff happens, and you know, that's the whole reason for investigation, is to try and determine where these shortcomings or deficiencies are. Are these one-offs? Is this a systemic problem? These are the kinds of questions that need to be answered so that we can get those answers and come up with solutions.
We'll take a short break to talk about one of our sponsors. Pilots know it's little details that matter. That's why ProChalk, they make high-quality premium rubber wheel chocks designed to protect your plane. They are even personalized with your tail number or business logo. Every set of ProChalk wheel chocks is made right here in the USA by a small family business that's proud to serve the aviation community. With the holidays coming up, they make an awesome gift. Practical, personal, and built to last. Check them out at ProChalk.com and use code FLIGHT10 for 10% off your order. That's ProChalk.com with code FLIGHT10 for 10% off. ProChalk, small business, big support for your plane.
And Todd, I know that we have a viewer that had written in about piloting command responsibility. And when we talk about these on-ground collisions, The pilot in command still has the responsibility for the safe operation of the aircraft, whether it's in the air or on the ground. Until that airplane is chocked at the gate and the engines are shut down and people are getting off, that pilot is responsible, and that pilot PIC is responsible for the operation. And we've talked about the 91.3, FAR 91.3, pilot responsibility and the capabilities. And the way I've always characterized it is, you know, a famous superhero and their mantra, with great power comes great responsibility. And that's what 91.3 gives to a pilot, because it gives them all the responsibility in the world because of the power that they have. They can do anything they want. They can violate any regulation in the interest of safety. And you know, that is a great responsibility.
And as those of you watching the video version of this, we're flashing up the actual regulation. This is a Federal Aviation Regulation, FAR 91.3, Responsibility and Authority of the Pilot in Command. Surprisingly, there are a lot of people who are pilots in command and don't know it. For example, in the world of the FAA, even a drone is considered an aircraft, and the person operating that drone is considered the pilot in command. So if you're out there flying a drone for fun, got it out of the box from wherever, and you're having a good time with it, have a good time with it. And if you're not doing anything dangerous or silly, then no one's going to question your pilot in command responsibilities, because if you're just flying it in your backyard, yes, you're the pilot in command, but you're not doing it in a way that you're trying to hurt somebody, or you're trying to fly in the front of another airplane, or doing something really crazy. But in this particular case, we have a person who got himself into a situation because of decision-making. And because he was the only person in the airplane, he was the pilot in command by default. He was a fairly low-time pilot with flying a Cessna, Cessna 172. But by his own admission, he'd had thousands of hours flying ultralights. So he was an experienced pilot in one kind of aviation, but he's fairly new in another kind of aviation. And I'm going to read parts of this because it's a fairly long comment he made. He's talking about he typically flies a glass cockpit, 172. This time he was flying a six-pack. Had about 20 hours total time, and he felt comfortable. It was a good day flying. Did his pre-flight, probably because of John's influence. He made a specific point talking about his thorough pre-flights. By the way, this person had a background as a professional truck driver. So by his own admission in his statement, he said he's very familiar with pre-flight and making sure everything is okay before he goes out. He gets into the airplane. He starts a taxi, tries to make a left turn. And he's using his rudder partly to make the turn. Couldn't do it. Airplane wouldn't turn. He had to put the brake on in order to turn left. He's thinking, this isn't right. He taxis back to the maintenance shop. He's at a flight school, by the way. So he asks one of the A&Ps, one of the mechanics there, to take a look at it. And those of you watching the video version, I'm putting the actual statement that this person said, oh, you know what? We didn't tell you who this person was. I fly 1976. Thank you very much for sending us in. He said, we had on-duty mechanics on site, and I told them what was going on. He, an individual mechanic, came out and looked at it, started it, taxied a bit, and shut it down. He told me it was fine, and the plane had just had the 100-hour, meaning 100-hour inspection, and had been flown several times. He said it was just rigged that way. Now, before the show, the three of us were talking about this, and John and Greg, you both had something to say about the 100-hour inspection and what this statement really means.
At a 100-hour inspection, the mechanic is required to check all the flight control systems, check the linkages, the control freedom, you know, as far as the bell cranks, the hinges, the cables, make sure that it's rigged properly. So you're looking for freedom of movement. You're not looking for binding. And for this mechanic to make a statement that it's just rigged that way makes no sense. And John, I think, you know, they may have pencil whipped this. That would definitely be one of the aspects of if this was an event that was to be investigated, that's one of the things I'd be asking is, let me see what you did on this 100-hour, because you shouldn't be having these kinds of issues.
No, there's no question that, you know, he may have done some additional work after he looked at it and didn't go back and check it. So there's some things that might enter into the sequence of events here. But in any event, at the end of a maintenance check, somebody in maintenance should look at the airplane. And then the pilot, when he comes out, should look at it again and check all the flight controls and make sure they all move in the direction that he thinks they're moving in. So it usually takes two people to do that.
And in one of the statements in our listeners' write-up was the fact that the mechanic said several other people had flown this aircraft. Well, I'd be hunting those people down to see if, in fact, they had any issues with the airplane not being able to turn left or any kind of stiff or tough flight controls and things like that. I wouldn't just take it at face value.
What the person didn't say is whether the mechanic who came out and tested the airplane was the person who was either the single individual or part of a team of individuals who did the 100-hour inspection. So it's unclear to me whether this mechanic just saw the paperwork said the 100-hour was done, or the mechanic had personal experience with doing part or all of the 100-hour inspection. So again, had there been an NTSB investigation, that should have been asked. I say if it had been an investigation. The story continues. He basically gets back in the airplane, takes off into a crosswind. He tries to put in some left rudder, nothing. He says, I was in a skid just a few feet off the runway with no way to kick the rudder for coordination. I chopped the power, pulled mixture and landed crab, nose into the wind to the right, and no way to straighten it out. Off into the grass I went. All I could do is keep the upwind wing down and ride it out using the left brake to keep from hitting aircraft parked. Good news is, he walked away from it. Afterwards, he said, he could see a mechanic and a couple of people from the flight school running out to me. The chief mechanic asked what happened. I explained, and he got in the plane with me. He started it up, and we were unable to get the plane to turn left without the brake. He said the chief mechanic. He didn't call the other mechanic the chief mechanic, so at least two mechanics looked at this, it seems, one before the takeoff and one after it. He asked me why I accepted the plane in that condition. I told him about the discussion I had with the other mechanic. He didn't say anything. He just turned red, and we said no more. So, John, I have a question for you. As a master mechanic, why do you think his face turned red? Because he was mad at his organization, he was mad at the pilot, or he was mad at himself, because he is the chief mechanic after all?
Probably a bit of two. Mad at himself and mad at whoever it was he knew, obviously, who did it. And I'm sure there was some pretty strong words after that. And maybe even employment issues after that.
And interestingly, there were no strong words said by the chief mechanic to the pilot.
Well, what's missing in all this? I want to know why the airplane wouldn't turn left.
Yeah. You know, they didn't even talk about maybe debris getting into the pedals.
Or you had a jam cable came off of a pulley or something. You know, I mean, because this is a very simplistic system. We're not talking torque tubes, hydraulic lines, and, you know, all sorts of stuff. We're talking, you know, a series of cables. I fly radio-controlled airplanes. It's almost similar to, you know, rigging a radio-controlled airplane where you got a push rod that moves the nose wheel in opposition with the rudder, so on the servo. And this is a similar setup. It uses a series of cables that interconnect with the rudder pedals. And, you know, you jump the left rudder pedal, the nose wheel turns left. So it's not a very complex system. So for the aircraft or the pilot not to be able to turn the aircraft left, does that mean that the rudder pedal was also jammed and you weren't getting full left rudder deflection or right rudder deflection when you move those rudder pedals? That's all part of a pre-flight. You're feeling for any kind of binding. You're feeling for any kind of rough operation, whether you're pushing and pulling the control yoke. I mean, I know people that'll fly the airplane with a ratcheting yoke. They pull it back and forth and it jerks coming back and forth. There's a problem there because the yoke is not supposed to do that. And that's the whole purpose of doing a thorough and methodical pre-flight, like you preach all the time, John, is not only going through the motions, but understanding what it is that you're looking for or feeling for or listening for while you're doing those types of pre-flight activities.
You know, and if I remember right, when you move the rudder pedals on that airplane, you're moving to both sides of it. See, when you push the right rudder foot all the way down, the left rudder comes back. He doesn't mention that at all.
So, yeah, and that's why, you know, I would love to know what they found. You know, was there an interconnect problem? Did they have, you know, a jammed cable or something to that effect? I mean, you know, they're still part of the story that maybe we have to, as investigators, have to follow up on, Todd, with our guy that submitted that, so that we can find out and tell the rest of the story.
And let me fill you in with the rest of his submission. He finishes his submission by saying, "I write this because I want pilots to understand how easy it is to convince yourself to fly a plane when you shouldn't. Yes, an ANP told me I was clear, but I was the PIC, and even with 20 hours, I knew better. I was able to respond with a proper rejected takeoff, but it should have never come to that. I had an experienced CFI sitting in the FBO that I could have easily asked to come check it out, but I didn't. I will never, ever accept an aircraft that doesn't 100% check out to my standards, not someone else's. I'm an aspiring professional pilot with 800 hours and, as of a few weeks ago, a builder. Guys, it's easy to find reasons to fly. It takes discipline and a firm commitment to personal minimums to say no. Please stay safe and know if you have any questions at all as to airworthiness, stay on the ground. Happy flying."
And, you know, I give plaudits to a guy like that who, one, confesses he made these mistakes, two, recognized those mistakes and used it as a learning lesson not to do it again. There's a lot of people that would just blow it off, write it off that, okay, yeah, that happened to me, I'll never do it again kind of thing, and they don't change their ways. So I give our listener a lot of credit for, one, providing that to us so that we could talk about it, but two, at least learning from that to be a better pilot, a safer pilot.
And this is one of those things where, because there apparently was no damage to the aircraft, it very likely didn't end up in any sort of investigation. And this sort of hangar flying that we're doing now, sharing the story with others, might be the only way that lessons learned can be shared with people other than those immediately involved in the event.
One of the things that I try to really push on flight schools is this. If you're going to do one, you should be doing an internal investigation. Regardless of whether it was a reportable incident or not, you should be doing your own internal investigation to find out if you have a problem in the organization. Is this a systemic problem or is it an isolated event? And then, as we just discussed, identify all of those issues. But then when you do your safety stand down, which if you aren't as a flight school, you should be, not only with your flight instructors, but with all the folks that that fly at your flight school, you should be doing a safety stand down every quarter and use these types of events as lessons learned, not to chastise anybody, but to use them in a positive manner that, hey, look, this is what a pilot did. This is how he got himself in trouble. And this is the lessons to be learned so that it doesn't happen to you. Man, I got everybody quiet.
That means that things that had to be said have been said, and we got nothing more to say, so it's time for the second to last word.
Wow. Showstopper. I must have just dropped the mic with that one.
You did indeed. So what is my second to last word? I got to tip my hat again to iFly 1976. When we say that we want to have your comments and we want to have your input, we're serious about it. I mean, come on. This is like a very good show we have here, and we hope that we're giving some good information, not just to iFly 1976, but to all of you out there. And again, follow this example. Like Greg said, you have an organization, something like this happens, somebody should be doing an internal investigation. It doesn't have to be huge. It doesn't have to be complex. But this is the kind of experience and kind of knowledge that should be shared so it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, Yeah, because these are the kinds of investigations I do on behalf of flight schools and flight departments. They want an independent, they usually call me so that I can be the bearer of bad news, per se, but use it in a positive way. So with that, John, I will leave you with our last word.
And as usual, I'll talk about pre-planning before you go to the airport. Do a good job of checking the weather and doing all your pre-planning. When you get to the airport, do it again, independently of the first one. If they don't agree, find out why. When you get out to the airplane and doing a pre-flight, don't do what this guy did and just accept the problem on the airplane, because he, in simple terms, he had, I want to go flying. In his mind, he wasn't going to miss the day flying. So he disregarded a lot of cues that should have had him stop. And after you take off, make sure you put that head on a swivel, because there is a lot of people out there that are new that are not having their own problems, and you don't want to become part of it. So put that head on a swivel so you know what's going on around your airplane. We talked about an airplane in LaGuardia where neither one of those pilots had their head on a swivel. You know, moving airplanes. I've got a lot of accidents in and around the fuel pumps and taxi accidents for little airplanes. And one of these days we'll be getting into all of those. But boy, is there a lot of them. You know, they're not big damage. You know, that nobody gets killed. So it gets sort of, you know, you get called a dummy and it gets, you know, people laugh at you and it goes away. It's all indications of sloppy operations. And please don't have a sloppy operation. Please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetodetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Without the right insurance, your Sierra, Oscar, Lima. Since 1961, Avemco Insurance Company has been known as the approachable experts of general aviation insurance. No other insurance company connects you directly to an aviation underwriter, giving you more flexibility, personalized service, and easy-to-read policies customized for you and your flying. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote, or visit Avemco.com/flight safety. And don't forget to tell them you're a listener of our podcast and save 5%.
That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detectives. Until the next episode, fly safe.